The next matter on for oral argument this morning is case number A180942. The parties are Pimiji versus Digital Town. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing the name correctly. Close?
Yes.
Spot on? Very good. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument, with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. The podium will indicate both the timing restrictions and also provide a button for you to elevate or lower the platform to your height at your convenience. Not to rush you, but counsel, whenever you are situated, appellant's counsel, you may proceed with your argument. If I didn't say so, please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. If I did say so, forgive me for my lapse in short-term memory.
If it please the court, counsel, my name is Craig Byram. I am here to argue on behalf of my client, Digital Town, Inc., the appellant in this matter. Digital Town has appealed from two orders, one entered by the court filed on February 26, 2018, and one entered by the court and filed on April 19, 2018. Essentially, these two orders constitute a series of summary judgments or summary determinations of issues that were up to that point in dispute between the parties. Digital Town is here today to suggest that summary judgment was inappropriate in all respects, as determined by the trial court. And I will not spend a lot of time on facts and background, because I believe both sides have spent a considerable amount of time, both in the trial court record and in the appellate briefs, articulating that. So I want to get right to the issues.
Just so I'm clear.
Sure.
Were both of these decisions based on summary judgment? Were either of them purportedly motions to dismiss?
They were.
It's unclear from the analysis of the district court.
Sure. And that is one of the issues, is that the trial court procedural status is a little clouded by counsel actions, naming things, approaching things. These things were filed initially as motions to dismiss, Rule 12 motions, motions in limine. Lots of labels were applied to them. However, the trial court said, these are dispositive motions. You're asking to dispose of the case in its entirety, and so the court's going to treat them as a motion for summary judgment. Appropriate time then was allowed for the parties prior to the court's determination of those issues, and the court approached it as, first, we're going to determine liability issues. We're going to decide whether there was a contract that can be enforced. Then we're going to decide what damages are under that contract, and so the summary judgment motion is the tipping point, and everything that flowed after that was really just an extension of that same.
I thought the district court applied a Rule 12 standard to the counterclaims, and I'm looking at page 3 of the addendum.
The counterclaim was dismissed. That is accurate, pursuant to Rule 12. It was summarily dismissed without much of discussion beyond the pleadings themselves. That is true.
Why is the date on which the parties signed the employment agreement, why is that a material fact?
It blends into a number of different open-ended questions that would need to be resolved by a jury. The testimony of Mr. Mills, who, as both parties acknowledge, was the other director at the time of Mr. Pomaggi's resignation as a director and CEO, states that his discussions with Mr. Pomaggi about any contracts going forward would require approval by the board of directors. Mr. Pomaggi's timeline is that he entered into a contract the day that the new board of directors was put in place, however, moments before, I guess, is his theory. Therefore, the board of directors constituted no one other than Mr. Mills.
Was Mills only a board member, or did he have an executive position as well?
He was a board member. He was a director, member of the board of directors.
Who was the CEO at that time?
At that time, they were replacing the CEO with a new CEO who was put in place.
So what? I'm unclear about the argument why Mills lacked authority to sign the agreement. I mean, he is a board member.
He is a board member. His position was that the contract itself calls for board input as far as what the job description would be, the responsibilities would be, and that since this was such a significant or out of the ordinary contract, that he wanted it presented to the board of directors. His testimony is Mr. Pomegy understood that, knew that, and that in fact, if you follow the timeline that Mr. Mills states is accurate, this was in June. There was a board of directors that had a CEO and had multiple members. There was a four-member board at the time that Mr. Mills states this contract became something that was being discussed.
Was there evidence in the record about sort of the articles of incorporation or company policies about who has authority to enter into contracts on behalf of the company?
There is some testimony by Mr. Pomegy that low-level employees were hired by the CEO or by individual executive-level members. There is testimony by Mr. Mills that this is not a normal everyday. This is your former CEO who is essentially creating a golden parachute contract for himself. There are issues that are open. There are issues of whether the new board of directors, as they came in, was aware of this. This needs to be vetted. This needs to be discussed, and it will not be enforceable until that vetting and discussion occurs. And if you believe his timeline, that's in June. There is a new board of directors. There is new leadership. There are people who would want to weigh in on whether the old CEO should be employed in this capacity.
Can you explain for me in a concise way the questions of fact concerning damages?
Yes. First and foremost, there is a question as far as in the context of damages, there's a question as far as is the written contract the contract, or is the written contract being proven or alleged to be proven through ratification by conduct? Mr. Pomegy's argument is if he doesn't have a written contract, if the timeline is the way Mr. Mills describes it.
Yeah, I think I'm jumping over that now. My question is if there's a valid contract,
yes.
But what are the questions of fact? I mean, and that was done in a separate order, I think, yes. Right? The damages. I mean, what are the questions of fact that preclude partial summary judgment on damages?
Sure. So what I was saying is the trial court took the position that you're looking at a full two-year period of time in which she was going to calculate damages pursuant to the salary described in the written contract. Well, that raises a number of fact questions that were in dispute, which is, did it go into the second year or was there an obvious termination of the contract prior to its first anniversary? The contract says it'll go into a second year unless it's terminated. The employee, Mr. Pomegy in this case, could give 2 weeks' notice anytime he wanted that he was no longer interested in being employed, and the employer could provide 60 days notice that they were no longer interested in a second year on the contract. And so a number of different potential outcomes on damages can be achieved depending on what date you decide as a trial court is the date that there was a termination of that contract. You could go damages through February of 2016, which is the date Mr. Pomegy argues that he stopped working in any real way for Digital Town and, in fact, took replacement employment elsewhere. The court ignored that date and gave damages after that date. You could determine that the end of damages was May 11, 2016, which is the first anniversary of the alleged written agreement, by determining that both parties were acting as if they did not honor this contract in any way at that point. Mr. Pomegy had stopped working. Digital Town had shut the office down, closed down email and access to any information from Mr. Pomegy and stopped making payments to him prior to that time. So the argument would be that both sides said we're not going into a second year. You could determine that it was August 28, 2015. That was the date that the office was shuttered. That the emails were shut down, that Mr. Pomegy was given every indication that the company was no longer interested in him performing services for them. So the trial court just gave a carte blanche 2 years of damages without considering whether any of these actions during that period, that two-year period of time would modify or change the amount of the damages. There's a mitigation argument that was raised in the pleadings and in the arguments at the trial court, which is certainly in a wrongful termination, I need prospective wages claim, you have to consider whether replacement employment occurred. It would be expected that the plaintiff seek that replacement employment. Mr. Pomaggi did. He secured that employment. That employment was at $10,400 a month, which was at least close to his prior salary. That would have reduced damages. Trial court ignored mitigation entirely.
If I may, could we turn to the your counter, some issues and questions I have about your counterclaim?
Yes.
Counsel, first of all, as I understand it, you're saying the statute of limitations should be told because of fraudulent concealment. When we look at fraudulent concealment, kind of there's a reasonable duty, you know, people have to, is there a reasonable opportunity to discover the fraud? And when I look at the district court's decision, it's addendum 5, number 14, the district court's addressing that seems to be, but correct me if I'm wrong, saying all information regarding this buying and selling of Digitown stock was available to the board of directors, auditors, and regulators. So that, it seems to me, is where the district court's saying, well, they had that ability to discover if they'd used due diligence. Is that your reading as well? And it's because my question is, where in this record are the facts that would show, no, that's disputed?
Okay. The question of fraudulent concealment is in the area of the SEC filing that says by Mr. Pomaggi, I had nothing to do with this. I didn't orchestrate this, and I received no personal benefit from it. So until it's discovered that that information was false, there was no triggering event that would cause Digitown to look beyond that statement. So whether or not there was theoretically information that might have been held for some period of time by an auditor or some third party who might have possessed a document begs the question, would anybody reasonably have gone there to look, not knowing anything was amiss? But when you discover that you've been misled and you've been lied to about the legality of what happened, the involvement of Mr. Pomaggi, questions of whether Mr. Pomaggi was helping an insider brother to his own benefit,
and
then you can go and
look.
You're
saying the company didn't know about that until the fall of 2015, is that correct?
Exactly, exactly. It was when they started contacting these new shareholders and saying, Mr. Pomaggi is out, your new shareholder, and the shareholders would say to them, this was very odd. We wanted to buy from the company. Mr. Pomaggi wouldn't let us buy from the company. We had to buy from Mr. Pomaggi's brother. Can you explain that? Was the first opportunity that Digitown had to say, wait, what was happening under the radar that we weren't aware of?
A related question. So I'm looking at your, what I assume is your proposed First Amended answer and counterclaim. I mean, could you give us your perspective on how we should address this, which the district court never ruled on, as I understand it? I mean, so when we're looking to say, well, you know, are there material disputes of fact so that the counterclaim should go forward, you know, should we be looking at that?
Sure.
The original answer and counterclaim?
Sure.
And is there a difference?
Yeah, so I think that you should look at both the original counterclaim and the proposed amended counterclaim, because the purpose of the amended counterclaim was to say to the trial court, we've done some discovery, we've learned some new things, and because of that, we're going to start tailoring in more specifically, adding some of these facts about things that we have discovered since we originally drafted the counterclaim and were ignorant of some of these things. Now, it's difficult because the trial court does not really mention that or take any official action on it. I mean, certainly I agree with Mr. Olson that the trial court implicitly denied the right to file that amended counterclaim. However, the law says that those counterclaim amendments should be liberally granted when the record suggests that the facts are now different than they were, and when the parties have essentially litigated up to a point where they can be more clear. So at the appellate court level, I think you look at how is it originally stated, and there it was originally stated that there's been opportunities of corporation that have been usurped. There have been conversions of opportunities or rights of the company in favor of others. There has been breaches of the fiduciary duties.
I saw the usurpation of corporate opportunity in the counterclaim. Was that argued on summary judgment? I mean, did you argue that to the district court?
Yes, usurpation was described to the trial court.
I was just hard to tell since there was not a transcript, and but if I go back and look at your briefing, your briefs, will I find it?
Yes, I believe so.
I didn't, but I'll go back and take another look.
All right.
So one final question on that. In the district court, as you point out in your brief, makes a credibility finding about Mr. Mills. Do you read that to go just to the employment contract, kind of whether or not he had authority to enter into it, or also to address this issue about fraudulent concealment? Or do you know?
Maybe I'm misunderstanding the question. Is my argument that the trial court considered credibility of Mr. Mills on multiple issues or just a single issue?
Right.
I think the trial court considered not only credibility of Mr. Mills on multiple issues, but considered credibility of Willard Olson, considered credibility of Mr. Pomache, considered credibility of Sheila Moxness. What the trial court did is say, I have two competing stories here, two sets of facts. There's Pomage's side of the story, and then there's Digital Town's side of the story, and they are in conflict. And so I am going to decide which one I believe, and then I'm going to enter a court order. And it, fundamentally, that's where we are on appeal, is to say, summary judgment, that's not the right place to do that. At summary judgment, you're, as a trial court judge, simply supposed to say, are these in dispute? Yes, they are. Then trial. So we skipped the trial stage and we went right to the summary judgment stage, where on every issue you have to make a decision, is Mills and the people on Digital Town's side credible, or are Mr. Pomage and his witnesses credible? To your question about whether it was raised, there's briefing that was done beyond
your
transcript. Thank
you. Your time has expired, and you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Mark Olson, and I'm here representing the respondent, Richard Pomage. I've got some just brief comments I want to begin with. One of them is the allegation by counsel for the appellant that my client received some sort of golden parachute by way of the contract in issue. Fact of the matter is, my client gave up $625,000 of monies that were owed to him by the corporation at the same time he entered into the contract. So contrary to that position, he actually lost approximately $400,000 by entering into the contract, by voluntarily surrendering those monies that he had no reason to do so. Also want to point out that the allegation that my client stopped working February 2016 is not supported by the evidence. The fact is, Digital Town simply cut him off from any ability to work. They shut down his email access, shut down his email accounts. Despite doing that, Digital Town maintained throughout this proceeding in the district court that there was no contract. They never made any allegations or any discussions about when the contract was terminated. They said there was no contract. So there are no arguments below pertaining to, well, the contract was terminated in February 2016, it was terminated in May 2016, whatever the case may be. Furthermore,
was there, isn't it nevertheless a fact issue if there was a contract when it ended?
Really, there isn't, because it wasn't argued by Digital Town, and the contract is explicit. It calls for written termination notice to be given to my client in this case. There is absolutely no written notice ever identified by Digital Town. And again, Digital Town maintained there was no contract and didn't argue anything beyond that. Under the law, Digital Town says that 181 doesn't apply because we don't know when the termination date was. Well, that may be the case where you've got an at-will contract, an at-will employment situation. That isn't the case here. We've got a written contract. That contract terminated on a date certain, and that is the quote-unquote discharge date that should be utilized.
So can I just ask you my really basic contract claim here? I mean, sure. Contract question. So Jeffrey Mills claimed he didn't have authority to sign the contract. District court says he lacks credibility, which should not be addressed. I think you typically is not addressed in summary judgment. Why don't we just have to reverse that?
Because I don't think that that comment was the basis for the court's decision. I think the court agreed with our arguments that under no set of circumstances presented by Digital Town taking all the allegations to be true, could a decider of fact reasonably under any circumstances find in their favor.
So you want this court to do our own summary judgment analysis, setting aside credibility issues, instead of reversing and remanding to the district court to do that?
Well, the court on review of a summary judgment determination reviews it de novo. So it'd be asking the court to look at the same facts and circumstances and either agree or disagree with the district court in its determination. I think it's important that I stress some factors that don't appear in Digital Town's brief, didn't appear in the oral arguments here today. And that's the fact that Mr. Mills falsified board of director minutes in the course of the litigation. Those were submitted through discovery. Again, they were falsified documents by Mr. Mills. There were documents not produced in discovery that were extremely pertinent to determination of the issues before the court. Those were emails between Mr. Mills and the new CEO in May of 2015 after the contract was entered into that specifically discuss my client having the contract, that specifically reference the payment my client was to receive under the contract, that specifically reference the reason why it was important that my client continue on with the company for continuity purposes. They weren't provided. They were hidden from us. We found them through the former CE or CPA of the company. And I think that just goes to show the, let's call it unclean hands Digital Town has in this matter, in addition to all of the other the failings. I think we cited about 60 different facts that prove the contract existed. All we have is Mr. Mills' claim that didn't exist.
So I could turn to a question on the counterclaim, on Digitalon's counterclaim.
Sure.
Where they're, and once again, this goes to, was there fraudulent concealment, you know, the affirmative act and all that. And then it gets to was the ability to discover the fraud, was there reasonable diligence? And I'm looking at a series of cases that say that's usually a question of fact. Why wouldn't that be the case here?
Because we would submit the record as conclusive that they had knowledge of that information and that it was discoverable because of the fact that their CPAs reviewed all the documents. Their outside auditors reviewed all the documents. These documents were signed off on by Jeff Mills. We're talking about here a situation where there were millions of these subscription agreements. Thomas Pomajay had 5% of them. At the trial court level, Digital Town went through the same canard they did on appeal, and that is they created facts that don't exist in the record. They argued that their argument is basically three points. One is that my client solicited the sale of shares of his brother's subscription stocks, which he owned, not his brother. There's nothing in the record supporting that, not a thing. That my client allegedly falsely told prospective buyers they could only buy Thomas's subscription stock. The one thing that comes close to that in the record is an affidavit from a gentleman by the name of Mr. Bauer. And Mr. Bauer doesn't say what Digital Town represents, he said. What he says is Richard Pomajay told him the check had to be made out to his brother. Okay, well, that's how it was done. Subscription shares were purchased with the checks made payable to the person owning the shares, not the company. The person owning the shares would then turn around, deposit the money, pay whatever taxes there might be, or if there's a loss, not pay any taxes on it, and pay that money back to the corporation. There's no evidence that didn't occur with Thomas Pominger or any other person. The other allegation is that my client allegedly retained the profits for himself. And again, there is nothing in the record supporting that claim, nothing whatsoever, nothing demonstrating it. In fact, the only individuals who would have knowledge of that both disputed it. And that's Thomas Pominger said, I never gave any money to my brother or anyone else. Sheila Moxness explained the process, who, by the way, was not my client's secretary.
All of those factual disputes, that is one of the questions I had kind of from another perspective, which is the statutory immunity under Minnesota Statute 302A, you know, whatever that portion, I'm sure you're familiar with.
Right.
So there's like a good faith that, as I recall, the district court said the respondent was entitled to that statutory indemnification.
Right.
And there's a good faith requirement to get that indemnification. Why, just given just everything, the disputes you just talked about, isn't there at least a question, a fact, regarding good faith?
Digital Town did not present any proof in support of any of their claims and their counterclaim. Nothing. And therefore, there is really no factual dispute to resolve. The indemnification statute does require showing a good faith. I believe the way that the trial court discussed the issue in its determination was that there's no demonstration of bad faith here. Therefore, it's got to be acted on in good faith. And if you look at the circumstances of the case, they sued my client without any legal basis whatsoever. My client prevailed on a dispositive, after a dispositive hearing. How on earth could there possibly be any facts that he acted in anything but good faith in defending the action that he prevailed in? I don't think the statute is absolute that every case requires a determination of a specific factual determination of good faith. It would stretch it would stretch any kind of argument or any kind of belief by anyone making a determination of credibility regarding such facts or making a determination of the good faith nature, of my client's position to find anything but good faith. How could there be anything but good faith if there was no wrongdoing found by the court? And the fact of the matter is, no wrongdoing found by the court in a dispositive setting again. There are some other issues I wanted to address briefly. One of them is this usurpation of corporate opportunity. Digital Town takes offense in its reply brief with the claim by my client that they didn't plead usurpation of corporate opportunity. They didn't plead that. There are three counts that were pled, none of which actually addressed the actual elements of the claims that they brought against my client. One of the counts was a conglomerate of two separate counts.
Mr. Olson, I'm looking at paragraph 32 of the First Amendment answer and complaint, where it talks about, you know, Digitel was harmed, and it lost corporate opportunities to sell stock to interested buyers.
I understand
Isn't
that.
Isn't that enough?
That is simple. That doesn't even discuss what's required to demonstrate what a usurpation claim is. It's not set forth as a usurpation claim, and I would submit to the court that it was merely dicta thrown in there to describe what they were trying to get at, but that's not what they pled. So they didn't plead that in specificity. The other thing is, with a usurpation claim, there has to be property belonging to the corporation. That's number one. That's the first step in the claim. My client had no property belonging to the corporation. Subscription shareholders own the stock that they purchase, and the corporation has no right to dictate what is done with any of that.
I think they were saying, as I recall in the brief, that Digitem was saying, well, that your client directed purchasers to buy from your client's brother rather than the company. Isn't that what they're saying? Could you address that for me?
Yeah, there's the one affidavit from Mr. Bauer who says that Mr. Pomajay said, you need to write the check out to my brother. It doesn't say that's the only way you can do it in that affidavit. It's like a two-page affidavit. And so there is no allegation that my client said that that was the only way he could do it. There are allegations in the complaint that there are numerous individuals who told them that. We asked for identification of who they were. We weren't given any names. So it was merely an allegation without any supportable facts behind it. And again, the Bauer affidavit doesn't say that my client said the only way he can purchase stock is through his brother. These are people who own stock in the corporation. They know you can buy it on the market. That's a ridiculous position of somebody who is knowledgeable in the purchase of investment stocks or whatever they may be. So, again, there's nothing in the record supporting the claim that my client did anything of the sort. And it really, let's assume that he did that. The corporation is the ultimate beneficiary of the sale under those circumstances. So regardless of which subscription holder might have stock, the corporation gets the money. So it's unclear how Digital Town would be damaged, even if their position was true, and we assert it is not. Digital Town had over a year to amend their counterclaim, and they waited until we brought summary judgment and Rule 12 motions. One quick answer to a question. The trial court did deny the request to amend. It set forth in some emailed trails in early March of 2018. I can identify it for the court if the court wants it, but it's an attachment to an affidavit of Lucas Thompson. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any rebuttal?
It's hard to know which aspect of the court of the various disputes here to focus on. I think that I'll just make general comments. Yes.
Just for the benefit of the audio recording, if you could state your name as you.
Oh, sure, Craig Byram again on behalf of Digital Town.
Thank you.
Thank you. I think that the questions are good and focus on the issue. There are lots of disputed issues of fact. Most of Mr. Pomajay's responsive brief describes disputed issues of fact, cites record to describe those issues. From Mr. Pomajay's perspective, the argument appears to be I won at the trial court saying that my client or that I didn't do anything wrong and therefore all legal issues can be set aside in my favor. That's not how it's supposed to be done. At the trial court, as I said earlier, we present facts on both sides. The trial court at the point of summary judgment says, is there a dispute? In this case, there was a dispute. The only option for the trial court then is to say, let's vet that dispute in a trial.
Mr. Olson argues that your client did not present a dispute as to the timing of a contract, only the existence of a contract in the district court. Can you point us to argument or evidence in the record that would make an issue of the timing as opposed to the existence?
Sure. Literally, the only two people on the planet who know when that contract was discussed are Mr. Pomajay and Mr. Mills. Mr. Pomajay said it was executed or presented and signed May 11th. Mr. Mills says it was presented to him June 15th. That is all of the evidence that's in the record from either side that really pins down that date.
I think the argument, though, Mr. Olson's making is that what was argued by your client in the district court was not the timing of a contract, but the existence of a contract. And because the timing was not in dispute in the district court simply decided a contract existed and then based its termination date as the one described in the written document.
Digital Town's filings in the trial court had a fair amount of focus on whether Mr. Mills recalled the date as being June 15th or May 11th because that led to questions of who was the board of directors, Would someone else have had to approve this contract? Was it approved? Did Mr. Pommaget ever mention this to the other members of the board of directors? It led to all of the questions that were being raised in the trial court.
Is Mr. Olson correct that the only argument that was presented by your client in the district court based on those facts was the existence of a contract as opposed to the timing of a contract if a contract existed?
He's not correct in the sense that the timing of it is at the core of the question of whether the written contract is a valid and enforceable written contract.
Right. I'm just trying to get a sense of whether you would concede that it was not expressly argued to the district court as to the timing of the contract as opposed to the existence of the contract.
I would concede this aspect of it, I guess. The timing is important in the context of Digital Town's argument that there's not a valid and enforceable contract, because if it was done in June, there was a board of directors, there was an express understanding in June between Mr. Mills and Mr. Pommaget that they were not the only actors at that time. There were other members of the board of directors who needed to be involved in the decision. So maybe I'm missing the nuance of the question, but the timing was important as a factor to decide whether the written contract was legit and valid and enforceable, or whether it was something that was a discussion between two people who didn't have the authority to finalize it. And as far as determining whether they had the authority or not, the contract itself says we're going to decide what the job actually is by the board of directors, and the board of directors was never asked that question, never weighed into that, answering that question, which then leads to the question of, did Mr. Pommaget ever perform his side of the contract? Did he ever do anything that was expected of him under the contract? The only way to know that is to ask the question, did the board of directors ever have an opportunity to tell him what his responsibilities were? It was kept from them, so they didn't. The factual questions roll from the timing question. The statutory questions that we haven't spent a lot of time on are frankly the easiest. The 181 says, for penalties and fees to be applied, the court has to focus on what wages or salary was due and payable at the date of discharge. Mr. Pommaget asserts that there was no date of discharge, which his argument's actually less beneficial to him than my argument. Digital Town's argument is there was a date of discharge. That date of discharge was in dispute. The trial court had to determine that before it got to 181 penalties. The 302A raises all the questions of good faith and everything. Mr. Pommaget agrees those questions are before the trial court, never addressed by the trial court, so they're a problem with that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Byram. Mr. Olson, thank you for your briefing, for your oral argument today. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.